we have anything recorded also, I want to back up because people have asked me.
Okay, yes, we're ready to start. There's an old joke when some members of the rabbinate back 50, 75 years ago took a very modern turn. The joke was then rabbis started becoming doctors, Judaism started getting sick. But today we have a different phenomenon of doctors, psychologists who are mumchim, experts in their field, who are also tamid chachamim and bring the wisdom of Torah to their chachma, to their art. And one of the greatest people in that regard is Dr. David Fox, a renowned Talmid Chacham, Rav of the Hashkama Minyan by Rabbi Krause Shulba, Young Israel, renowned Talmid, studied under Meir Shashiva. Unlike me, he actually studied by Rav Moshe. I just came by his son. And, of course, a close Talmud of Rav Simcha Wasserman Zatzal, as well as leading expert in field of psychology, professor at UCLA, same time a member of the Bezidim Yushalayim, very, very unique person. And interning under Dr. Fox is our own Rabbi Dr. Mati Klein, Talmud Chacham, someone who has been making his mark in the field of psychology as well, and then he's, I guess we call a Rebbe-Talmud relationship. The topic tonight, we all experienced the wrenching, gut-wrenching feeling. We heard the terrible news from Pittsburgh 2 weeks ago. And the question is, how do we react? We spoke on a spiritual level how to react, but on a psychological level, there's two extremes. One is to basically say, this is happenstance, it happens, it's one in a billion chance, it's not going to happen again anywhere, just go back to normal life and just completely ignore it and just unplug from it. That's certainly not a Jewish response. On the other hand, if we become so obsessed and paranoid with it and we can't function, us or our children for that matter, that's certainly also not a Jewish response. So how do we, between those two extremes, how do we navigate our response to trauma? That's really the topic tonight. So without further ado, we'll start first with Rabbi Dr. David Fox.
Thank you, Rabbi Stern and Rabbi Brander. And it's a sad honor to be asked to speak on this topic tonight. Just by clarification, in terms of what I'm doing here and what my esteemed colleague, Rabbi Dr. Klein, is doing here, we are both involved with something called Project Chai. Project Chai is the Trauma, Crisis Intervention, and Bereavement Department of Chai Lifeline International. And I direct that department internationally. And we provide crisis intervention and training for first responders in Jewish communities all over the place. We've trained teams in Antwerp, in Israel, in Kansas City, in Montreal, in Melbourne, New York, Hasidic, non-Hasidic, religious, non-religious. And we are approaching the close of a training locally for volunteer interventionists who, in the event, God forbid, in the event that there is a tragedy in our community, this team of well-trained volunteers will be mobilized to provide crisis intervention, whether it's a natural disaster, such as the one that is on the periphery of Los Angeles right now with these horrible fires, whether it's let's call it a human-made disaster, whether it has to do with, God forbid, sudden death or suicide, any of the many, many catastrophic events that at times show up in our midst. So we have a team that has been carefully trained and carefully selected, and Rabbi Dr. Klein will be one of the main interventionists, hopefully leading that team for Los Angeles and the Valley. So this is our specific qualification to come here tonight. I'm going to speak first, obviously. I'm going to talk about the nature of trauma and what is a Jewish attitude when any of us is affected by tragic events. And then Dr. Klein will be speaking in a more pointed way about what to say to children and how to understand some of the reactions that are sadly enough common when our families and ourselves are faced with crisis. By way of very simple introduction, or simple definition, let's clarify that a crisis is any event that you're exposed to, for which you don't have an immediate response and you're caught off guard. So many things qualify as a crisis. They're not all traumatic, but a crisis is a situation that's going on outside of you, whether it's, God forbid, a diagnosis, whether it's witnessing something very awful, whether it's bad news, but anything that shocks you and for which you don't have an immediate response and need a few moments or a little while to recalibrate, we call that a crisis. Now, a trauma, in contrast, is a particular type of crisis which involves an event, usually an external event, something going on in the environment around you or in your social circle or in your family or sometimes in yourself. And a trauma is a type of crisis for which you have no prior experience, you have no reference point in your memory with which to make sense of what's going on. So it's a more aggravated and complex type of crisis, because not only are you caught off guard and in shock and not knowing what to do, but you really can't locate inside of yourself any reference point to begin making sense of that particular severe crisis. Generally, when we speak about a traumatic event, we're speaking about something that's major. It doesn't have to happen to oneself. One can be a witness to someone else's victimization, somebody else's trauma, or sometimes one can be the direct survivor of an event, and we'll say that that person's been exposed to trauma. Sometimes trauma ripples into family members who weren't present, who didn't survive it, they didn't witness it, but they heard about it because it involves someone who was close to them or someone dear to them. And then what we also see is that traumatic incidents, they ripple not only through family, but they ripple through neighbors, through other relatives, classmates, office mates. And whereas there are degrees of traumatization, sometimes they're referred to as trauma with a capital T, and sometimes trauma with a lowercase t, whereas there are different degrees of trauma, what they all have in common is when they occur, we're caught off guard, we're not sure what to do, and in those moments when we're caught off guard, what trauma does is it's affecting the brain itself, which means if any of you are as old as I am and you remember playing pinball, remember pinball machines? If you knock into the pinball machine, it says tilt. Anyone not know what I'm talking about? 25 cents, pinball machines. So you knock into the pinball machine and it says tilt, which means momentarily the machine can't operate because you've done something to jar its circuitry. And that's what happens when human beings are exposed to a traumatic incident, that the brain goes into tilt, which means that the circuits stop and all of the mental energy, we're going to call that electric energy, but all the mental energy which is going on in the brain, it gets channeled into parts of the brain that are unable to talk about what they're going through. So when we say that a person's been traumatized, or a person's been a victim of trauma, or a person has been exposed to trauma, what we're saying is that in those moments when they first encounter the shock and they don't know what to do, something is changing in their brain so they can't think clearly, they can't express their thoughts, And in those moments of traumatization, certain things begin to freeze in the brain. Now, many of you have raised children who have perhaps heard about something tragic or witnessed something tragic, an accident, or a family member became ill, and you'll find little traces of what I'm talking about. The child who, after that horrible event, they begin stuttering, they can't speak straight, or they go quiet, they don't seem to react, they seem to go into a numb state. Some of us can relate to that as adults, happening to us personally. But you have this image about the brain going on tilt. So now, with that just very cursory definition of what trauma is and what crisis is, let's talk about something Jewish. Let's talk about the Jewish attitude towards traumatic events. You know, our sages introduced brachas, blessings that we are to recite, and these are, of course, codified in Shulchan Aruch, but our sages introduced blessings, praising God with a blessing when we're exposed to scary events. So they may be thunder or lightning, they may be volcanoes or earthquakes, they might be tidal waves, they may be hurricane force or gale force winds, but each of these events are depicted in the Gemara, and all of them are codified in Halacha, that we have to say a blessing when we're exposed to these things. Now, I'm not going to get into all of the theology of praising God when good things happen, but also when scary things happen. But I will mention that one theme that the Talmud, one theme that the Gemara introduces about the rationale to have a blessing over a scary event is because it's supposed to register. It's not supposed to be overlooked. When scary things happen, even relatively small scary things like a horrible thunderstorm, which we don't get too often in California, but when you hear the heavens rattle and you see the flashes of lightning, so it's very easy for us to just continue driving the car, walking along, and not letting the event penetrate. And yet the sages say you're bound, according to Halacha, to stop, to take in the experience, and then to talk about it by recognizing that this is something God wants you to experience. And he wants you to recognize that he has majestic control and dominion over the universe, over the cosmos. And many, many, many times we forget it, but our lives, our safety, our security are contingent on Ratzon Hashem, what's going on in Shemayim. And for this reason, says the Talmud, that we've got to stop and say the blessing. We can't ignore trauma. We can't be immune or nonchalant or oblivious or self-distract when scary things happen. We've got to recognize them and talk about them, because if we don't, we numb out in very, very pathological and healthy ways. And real trauma, real scary events, not the thunder and the lightning, but real scary events, that if you don't stop and cognize, you don't stop and process them, if you don't allow them into awareness and to recognize something's going on, you're going to be traumatized, which means your brain's going to numb out, it's going to shut down, and later on, at different points in your life, the shock that you didn't react to, the horror that you didn't acknowledge, the fright that you didn't pay attention to, it's going to crop up, and as Dr. Klein will tell you, it's going to start generating other symptoms of distress at a later time. So, lesson number one, when scary things happen, pay attention to them. When frightening events go on, don't ignore them. Don't go into a denial or an oblivion as if they're not important to you. Lesson number two, let's go, now that we've talked about the blessings over tragic events, let's go to a very curious lesson, very curious interpretation that shows up in the Talmud, in the Gemara. In more than one place, we have the great prophets, the great Nevi'im, proclaiming that the Jewish nation is a human nation. The pasuk in one place is Adam Atem. You are the humans. So God, through the Navi, he designates somehow, in some way, the Jewish people as a human race, which is surprising because all of humanity is part of the human race. So because of this puzzling expression, Adam Atem, you are human, the Talmud makes an astounding interpretation. Now you have to stay to the end of this, because if you walk out now after what I'm about to say, you'll be very troubled by this drasha. You'll be very, 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 we'll get into the newspaper and none of us will look good. But the Gemara says, Adam Atem, Atem kruyim Adam, ve'ein ovdei kochavim kruyim Adam. That what the prophet's telling you is that you Jews are called people and the nations of the world are not referred to as people. Now, of course, that's very, very troubling on its face. It's so contrary what we say, what we believe, and what we want people to think we believe. And yet, this is what the Talmud says. And of course, this has been the source of dozens and dozens of efforts to explain what in the world did our sages mean when they proclaimed that we are called Adam and the rest of the world are not called Adam. So this question, what is the Gemara getting at? This was brought to the great Rosh Yeshiva in Lublin, Rabbeinu Meir Shapiro of Lublin. How many men learned Daf Yomi today? Good. So Daf Yomi, as you know, was inaugurated by this great rabbi in Lublin before the Second World War, Rabbeinu Meir Shapiro. So a Polish official, a politician in Poland, approached Rabbeinu Meir Shapiro and said, they showed me this passage from the Talmud that says the Jews are called people and Jews don't believe anyone else are called people. What does this mean? How are you going to defend this? And Rav Meir Shapiro's explanation is one that's important for us. Because he said, there are many, many words in Lashon HaKodesh, there are many words in Hebrew that are synonyms for a person. We can call someone Enosh, we can call people Anashim, we can call people Bnei Adam, we can call someone Gever. There are so many, many different words in Hebrew that refer to the human being. And Rav Meir Shapiro said, what the Talmud is jumping on is the use of this particular word, Adam, to describe the Jewish people. There's something special about that specific synonym that captures a quality that Jews have that nations of the world don't have. So the Polish politician, he said, explain. So he said, here we are in Poland today. What would you do if you heard that there was flooding in London? If you read in the newspaper that there was flooding in London? So he said, well, I wouldn't do much because the British take care of their own. So he said, well, what would you do if you heard that there were fires in Prague and it was burning through the city of Prague? And he said, well, I'd feel bad for the Czechs, but they have fire departments. They're very civilized. He said, what would you do if you heard that there was famine in Russia? And he'd say, well, look, that's a very big country, and they'd have to take food from different parts of that gigantic continent, and they'd feed their own. So he said, and let me tell you something. He said, when Jews here in Poland hear that there's flooding in London, they're immediately saying Tehillim, they're reciting Psalms for the Jews of London, and they're raising money to send across the British Channel to make sure people have food. And when we hear that there's fires in Prague, we immediately are saying Tehillim, and we're doing what we can to make sure that they have clothing and they have their needs met. And the same thing in Russia, and the same things in America, that when a Jewish community hears about other Jews suffering, we're supposed to be activated. We're supposed to feel it. We're supposed to respond. And he says, and this is what the Talmud was noting, that the word Adam is the same as the word Adama, which means a piece of land. And when there's an earthquake in a piece of land, the entire terrain feels the shock. And in that sense, Atem Kruyim Adam, the Jews have that ground-like quality, that Adam, Adama quality, that when things happen to other Jews anyplace else in the world, we do feel it. We feel the shockwave, we do respond, and as a result, when we hear about Jews in Pittsburgh, or we hear about Jews in the streets of Paris, or we hear about things happening in the Scandinavian Jewish communities, or we hear that there's bans on Shkita that are taking place in Belgium, when we hear that the Jewish community in particular is being afflicted, whether it's by natural disaster, whether it's by human-incited tragedy, whether it's pogroms, whether it's riots, whether it's persecution, whether it's other events that affect us. So not only do we traditionally mobilize ourselves, whether it's with the Tehillim campaigns, whether it's with the Mishaberichs, whether it's the fundraising, whether it's the convoys of trucks that we sent to Houston, Jewish people sent to Houston during their flooding so that the people who had no homes would at least have blankets and food. But not only do we mobilize at the tangible, at the physical level, but we're supposed to mobilize at the emotional level, which means that we are expected as Jewish people to have a sensitivity when things aren't right anywhere in the Jewish world. Now, we as adults, we often outgrow that. We anesthetize ourselves. We're busy with our own sorrows. We're busy with our own stresses. And so much of the time, we do numb out. But we have only to look at our children, as we're going to hear from Rabbi Dr. Klein. Look at our children, and children do resonate. They do resonate with fear and with anxiety and with sadness and with loss of appetite, things he's going to outline. When we hear about bad news, whether it's directly affecting us, whether we know someone who it's affecting, whether we've witnessed it or whether we've survived it, we're supposed to react. Look at our children and we see that it's part of the brain's natural circuitry to have some type of response when bad things happen. I'm going to close, because we are time bound, I'm going to close my introduction, or this is not an introduction to what I'm about to say, I'm going to close my remarks, which are the introduction, Rabbi Klein will take over, with one more source in the writings of our sages. What was the first natural disaster that the Jewish nation witnessed? Not as victims, not as survivors, but as witnesses. So it was the splitting of the Yam Suf. The splitting of the Yam Suf, the Red Sea or the Reed Sea, it wasn't our catastrophe because we all survived it. But nonetheless, the Torah tells us that we stood by and watched. We stood by and we watched troops of soldiers in chariots and riding horses. And we saw them not only sinking into the water, but being thrown up by the waves and crashed down onto the shore. And the Torah depicts for us in poetic form the catastrophe that was the demise of the Egyptian army at the Red Sea. And we live to talk about it. We commemorate it every day in Oz Yashir. And yet there is a verse in Oz Yashir, I'll draw attention to you. The men here who say Kiddush Levana are very familiar with this verse because it's in our ritual text one Saturday night per month, Kiddush Levana. But all of us who ever say the Tzuket HaZimra, who recite Oz Yashir, will recognize this verse. The verse says, Tipol Aleihem Emasav Avachad, Bigdol Zeracha Yidmukovin. Tipol Aleihem Emasav Avachad. It says, the nations of the world, Tipol Aleihem, fell over them, Emasa, Terah, Upachad, and trembling. Different types of fear. That the people who became aware of Kriyas Yamsuf were suddenly afflicted by terror and by fear. Now, what is the difference between ema and pachad? What's the difference in Hebrew between the word ema, which means some type of apprehension or fearfulness, and pachad, which means to be petrified? So what is the difference? So Rashi quotes a midrash. Rashi quotes a version of an interpretation given by our sages. And Rashi says that pachad al hakrovim, ema al harachokim, that the word pachad, the idea of being petrified by what you witness, this is something that applies to people who are direct witnesses, who are there on the spot. They see what's going on, and they're traumatized. They're petrified simply because they saw other people in a tragic, horrible situation, saw them perish and being tortured. And then the ema, the idea of ema, which is a different level of fear, which means like apprehensive. So the Medrash says, this is what affected the Rochokim, which means the people who didn't witness it directly, but that idea of a ripple that goes from society to society. So those nations who were standing on the hillside looking at the sea as the sea broke into pieces and people were drowning and screaming, so they developed pachad. They were petrified. That's trauma. The people who heard about it by word of mouth, the people who were far away and distant, didn't actually see it happen, but they heard about it because it was rumored around the known world that this tragic event had occurred to the Egyptians. So those people were also stunned, but they were stunned in a different way. They were stunned because they became apprehensive, which means their traumatic reaction was not one of petrified terror, but it was one more. Instead, it was something that goes sort of channeled up to the mind. The intellect can't deal with it. The mind can't grasp it. And that's what ema is. You just can't, as they say in English, wrap yourself around it. You can't get a grip on what this means. It's too difficult to understand, and it's a different level of traumatization. But we have now a couple of Torah sources, and sprinkled with a little bit of science, into understanding that when tragic events happen, particularly if they happen to our people, we feel a kinship, we feel a closeness, we feel a connection, Jew to Jew. But for that matter, any time a tragic event happens that we are exposed to, we experience, it's very, very appropriate to have a reaction. If we don't have a reaction, if we don't let it register in thought, in heart, in spirit, in conduct, and in the neshama, in our soul itself, then we are overly numb, and this is not a healthy sign. I'm going to stop, and let's hear the enlightening words of Dr. Klein, who give us some specific ideas about dealing with trauma.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Dr. Fox. As you heard from Rabbi Stern, Rabbi Dr. Fox has an immensely intense and busy schedule. He's literally flying all around the world every few weeks, so we really appreciate you taking the time to come here. I also just wanted to publicly thank Mr. Danny Hill, who really was the impetus for this lecture, in addition to the many things you do for the shul, but specifically this lecture, so thank you for really pushing us forward. Before I get to how we can speak to our children, maybe our grandchildren, for some people here, I don't want to insult anybody, but I just want to echo what Rabbi Dr. Fox said and Rabbi Stern in terms of how we react to these communal tragedies. If we look in the Torah, the tochacha, the passages of the Torah that speak about the terrible calamities, the terrible curses that will befall us if we don't follow God's plan for us, we actually can see the two extremes of how we should not react to tragedy. So if you look at there's two versions of the Tochacha in the Chumash, one in Parshas Bechukosai, one in Parshas Kisavo. If you look at the first version in Parshas Bechukosai, we have a verse that tells us, V'halachtem imi b'keri, V'halachti imachem b'chamas keri. Hashem says to us, in the midst of describing all the terrible calamities that will befall us, if we react to these terrible tragedies with callousness, with coldness, keri, with unfeeling, then Hashem will respond to us with that same sense of coldness, of callousness, of apathy to what's going on. And the Rambam, as Rabbi Brander quoted last week, famously says in the beginning of Hichos Tanios, it's kedai to hear as many times as we need to hear it, but if a person says that these things that are happening, it's just happenstance, right? It's just anti-Semitism. It's a given in the world. It will happen. And there's nothing we can do about it. There's no way we should react to it. It happens. The Rambam says, if a person reacts in that way, this is actually cruelty. Very strong lashon of the Rambam. It's cruel to be apathetic, to be not feeling when these things happen. That's one extreme, to unreact, underreact, to not react at all to when these things happen. On the other hand, the Tochacha also talks about what happens if we overreact. If you look in the Tochacha in Parshas Kisavo, the second version of it, we have a pasuk that tells us, again, this in the midst of describing all the terrible calamities that will befall us, the pasuk tells us, "V'nasan ol barzel al tzavarecha." Hashem will place an ol barzel, a yoke of iron, terribly heavy yoke, al tzavarecha, on our necks. What exactly does that refer to? The pasuk itself already describes how we're going to be enslaved by the other nations. So the amazing comment of Rabbi Elazar in the Yerushalmi in Maseches Shabbos, and again, Rabbi Stern's comment, the Tanaim, who obviously were great Talmidei Chachamim, they were amazing psychologists as well. They were the original rabbi doctors. So Rabbi Elazar says in the Yerushalmi, what's Ol Barzel? What is this iron yoke that is upon our necks that Hashem will put upon us? Ze Harayon. This is thought, is worry. And the Torah Tamima, Baruch HaLevi Epstein explains this a little further. He says, if we worry and we think so intensely, so deeply about these terrible things, the anxiety, that feeling of always worrying, always thinking about these things, will actually become an iron yoke upon us. Even if we want to throw off that yoke, it's going to take over us. It's going to take hold. And so the Torah is both warning about underreacting to trauma. We can't underreact to tragedy. But again, we don't want to overreact. We don't want to worry too much. We don't want to be burdened and filled with anxiety all the time. And therefore, we have to try, as hard as it is, to strike this balance between not underreacting and not overreacting. And again, in terms of speaking to our children or any younger people about this, that's really what we want to try to achieve. We want to achieve that balance between giving them the opportunity to talk about it, to talk about what they're feeling, what they're thinking, but not give them too much anxiety, too much worry about what could happen, what did happen. And so before I get to the different specific developmental periods of children and how each period we have to speak to children differently, I just want to say a few items that apply to all children of all ages. The first is that we can never assume or expect our kids to react in a certain way. And even based on what they've done previously, based on their personalities, we never know how children, or older children, younger children, will react to tragedy, to trauma. I'll just give you an example. I had, a number of years ago, I was seeing a brother and a sister who were a year apart. They're 9 and 10 years old. 9-year-old girl, 10-year-old boy. The trauma that they had experienced was they were walking home from school, public school. This was in East LA, not such a great neighborhood. And as they were walking down the street home from school, they heard some gunshots. And then they turned the corner and they saw what was the aftermath of, I think, a drive-by shooting. And they basically saw a driver in a car who was bloody and who had been shot. So they saw that, they basically turned the other way, they walked home, and that was their experience. So, and the school and the parents referred them because they had experienced this traumatic event. So I started seeing them, and one of them was completely fine. No traumatic reactions. They were fine, they went on. One of them almost had full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder. Flashbacks, couldn't concentrate in school, wasn't functioning properly at home. So if I ask you, which one do you think had the PTSD reaction? I'm saying the girl or the boy? Boy, the girl, right. So you might think the girl, you might think the boy. It was the boy, the 10-year-old boy, who actually had the full-blown PTSD symptoms. And the 9-year-old girl, she was fine. So we can never assume that we know, based on personality, based on gender, based on anything, how kids will react. And really, you know, it's just random, and we have to sort of try to get a sense of how the kid is reacting after these things happen. Another point is that reactions immediately after trauma, some either fear reactions or anxiety or worry, some of those are actually normal. As the famous Viktor Frankl said, an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is normal. So in the aftermath of an abnormal situation, if the kid has somewhat abnormal reactions, that's actually normal. The DSM, which is the manual that lists the mental health disorders and clarifies what the criteria are, says that in order for symptoms after trauma to be defined as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms have to last more than a month. I.e., if you're experiencing the symptoms within a month, that's normal. That's normal to have an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation. And the last point, before I get to the specific ages, is that, as many of us know, in our day and age, with media, with technology, with so much exposure to everything happening in the world, it's very hard to shield, to protect kids from hearing about anything that happens in the world. Even younger, even very young kids, you know, might see it somewhere, their friends might tell them. So it's very hard, unless they're very young, to actually shield them or sort of not let them find out about these tragedies and traumatic events that are happening all around us. As an example, my own children, my oldest is 8, and then 6, 4, and 2, so they haven't brought it up yet, and from sort of talking with my wife and getting a sense of what my kids' friends have talked about, we thought maybe the oldest one, the 8-year-old, would have heard about it in some form, and maybe her friends talked about it, but it seems like she hasn't. So that's sort of maybe the oldest age where they might not hear about it, maybe depending on the community, depending on the school. But once you get older than 7, 8, they're most likely going to hear about it in some way, and therefore we should give them the opportunity to discuss it. We shouldn't wait for them to come to us, but we should just have an open discussion. What did you hear about it? What do you know? What are your thoughts? What are your feelings? Just give them the space to talk about it. And in terms of talking to kids based on their developmental ages, so Chazal, our sages, were very aware of this. In the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos, they give specific ages for when to teach different parts of Torah, of Chumash, of Mishnah, of Gemara. They recognize that kids develop, their brains develop differently, and different stages of their cognitive development, they think differently. And so the way we speak to them, the way we teach them, the way we talk to them has to be specific to the way that their mind is understanding the world and understanding what's happening around them. So let me start with preschool. So preschool, we'll say it's ages around 3 to 6. Younger than 3, you know, they're really not going to talk about it in any capacity. And so when we think about these young children, preschool children, and what, how they understand the world, how they understand death and tragedy, so we have to realize that research has shown that until about 4 and maybe even older, kids do not understand the finality and the irreversibility of death. When you tell them somebody died, somebody passed away, they think that means they're away for a certain amount of time, they're going to come back. They don't understand that death is final and the person is never coming back. So even talking to them about these tragedies that occurred and people dying, if they haven't gotten to that level of understanding the finality of death, it's really not going to mean anything to them, because to them it means the people went away for some amount of time. So that's one thing to be aware of. As we know, young kids, preschool kids, are very egocentric. So everything is about them. Probably know many adults like that also, but young kids for sure are like that. So egocentric, everything is about them, about their experience. So if and when we talk to them about these events, they're going to make it very personal, right? Is this going to happen to me? Is this happening in my shul, in my family? They can't think of this as happening when we hear about these events, so we sort of make degrees of separation. It wasn't in LA, it was in Pittsburgh, even the fires, it's not here in the city, it's there. So we sort of separate ourselves in some way to make us feel somewhat secure. Little kids, if they hear it, they're just going to make it all part of their egocentric experience, and they're going to think, this is going to happen in my shul, in my school, in my family. And so we want to be very specific about how we talk to them about this. In terms of their thinking, everything is black and white. They don't really understand complexity, that one thing can have two aspects. It's really either this or either that. One just simple example, I was reading a bedtime story to my 4-year-old, and it was a story, one of these Ars Scroll books about Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. So we're reading a story, and I'm saying King and Solomon, so he stops me and he looks at me with this puzzled look and he says, this is a good king? I said, yeah. He said, it's a Jewish king? I said, yeah. He said, I don't understand. All kings are non-Jewish and bad. Why? Because all the kings he had learned about in school were Paro, Achashverosh, Antiochus, right? All he had learned about, for him, a king meant you're bad, you're evil, and you're not Jewish. So for him to sort of expand that definition in his mind and understand that, no, there are good kings, there are Jewish good kings, and then there are all the other kings that I learned about in school, that was very hard for him. And I could see the whole time he was sort of really struggling to process those two aspects. So again, kids this young really think of things as very black and white, very either or. So when it comes to, and I'll be very specific here, when it comes to if this young child, ages 3 to 6, has heard about it, and they ask you, will it happen to me, or will it happen in our shul, in our school, what you say to them is unequivocally, no, it's not going to happen to you, you're safe, it's not going to happen here, it's not going to happen in our shul, in our home, because again, they're so young. If you even allude to the fact that it may happen, they can't handle that dichotomy of it's 95%, 99% not going to happen, maybe 1% can happen. They don't understand that dichotomy. And therefore, if you tell them it may happen or even give them the impression it may happen, then they're really going to internalize that and they are going to develop anxiety or fear. So again, young children, if they ask you, will it happen to me? Be very clear, no, you're safe, you know, Mommy, Abba, whatever, are making sure you're safe. It's not going to happen to you. Unfortunately, I had an example of what not to say, this exact example. So again, another case, I was seeing a young child who was experiencing symptoms of anxiety. And one of the things she was experiencing is that whenever her mother did not pick her up from school right on time, if she was a minute or two late, the girl would go into this terrible panic attack. My mother's not coming, she's not gonna come, what's happening? She's a minute late, and the school didn't know what to do. You know, parents come late, it happens. So I spoke to the mother, and it became clear that a few times when the daughter had asked the mother, in some form or fashion, could it happen that, you know, something will happen to you, something bad will happen to you, and you might not come back, you might not come pick me up, you'll get hurt, or maybe you'll even die. And so the mother's response was, it could happen, you know, I don't know. And when the mother told this to me, she said, I didn't want to lie to my kid, you know, it could happen. And so the mother had good intentions, she was, you know, being honest. But again, for young kids, as we pointed out, you need to be very clear, no, it's not going to happen. You need to give them a sense of safety, security. And then as they get older, you can introduce the idea that, yes, these things may happen, very unlikely. And once they can understand the complexity of how these things work and the dichotomy, then you can introduce the idea that it may happen. So that's preschool. Now let's go to school age. So that's about ages 6 to 12. So middle school, elementary school. In terms of these children, as I said, most likely they will have heard about it, depending on the situation, depending on the school, but most likely, again, in our day and age, they probably will have heard something about it, either through friends or through community. And so, as I said before, for them, we want to be proactive and give them the opportunity to discuss it with us. So don't wait for them to come to you and say, you know, I heard about this, or I'm thinking about this, feeling this way. Be proactive, open a discussion with them and say, you know, this happened. What did you hear about it? What do you feel about it? What are your thoughts? And even if initially they say, I don't want to talk about it, you know, or I don't have any thoughts, I don't have any feelings, but at least you've given them the opening, and you can even say this. You say, okay, that's fine. If you ever want to talk about it, or if sometime later it does, you do have feelings or thoughts about it, then, you know, I'm open. I'm here to talk about it with you. Another thing to keep in mind at this age, as opposed to preschool children, again, they're very egocentric, and so they don't even have the skill of sympathy. Sympathy means that I can understand that another person has different feelings or different emotions than I do, and therefore even if I'm not in pain or sad or upset, but I can see that another person has those feelings, and I can perceive that. Again, preschool children, 3 to 6, do not have that ability. Once they hit school age, then they start developing that skill of sympathy, of being able to recognize that other people can be experiencing pain or sadness or anger, even though they're not. And therefore, with these kids, when these tragedies happen, they can find meaning in terms of doing things for others. They can understand that the people of Pittsburgh are in pain, are hurting. There's many families who lost people. And therefore, if you can channel their sense of sympathy for others into something meaningful, raising tzedakah for them, you know, taking some initiative, maybe taking on something, taking on a mitzvah, or doing some chesed, doing something that helps the victims, the survivors, that can actually help them, because now they're at the point where they understand that other people are experiencing pain. In terms, getting back to our question, if they ask, will it happen to me? So again, when it came to preschool children, we said unequivocally, no, it's not going to happen, you're safe, you know, and it's not going to happen to you. Now, in school age, where they already can understand complexity more, so here you can introduce, you can say, I can't promise it won't happen to you, but your parents, the school, the shul, the community is doing everything they can to make sure that you are safe. So very likely it's not going to happen, and we're doing everything we can. Yes, it might happen, there's a small chance, but again, at this age they can understand that dichotomy of most likely won't happen, may happen, and therefore in most cases they'll be able to stomach that, and they'll be able to be okay with that. At this age, one more point is that they may start asking theological, existential questions, right? Why did God let this happen? Tzadik v'ra lo, how could these terrible things happen to good people? right? Because they already know certain theological truths. And so for this age child, definitely validate their question. Say that's a really important question, and that question has actually been asked by our sages, our rabbis, going all the way back. And you can try, and you can give them general answers. If in any of these circumstances, when they're asking these theological questions, if you don't feel equipped yourself to give them the answer, then you could say that's a very important question. Let's go ask the rabbi. Let's go ask your rabbi. Let's go ask the teacher. Whoever you feel can answer those questions. And now let's get to teenagers, the last 5 minutes. So teenagers, as opposed to preschool, school age, they can understand things even more complexly. This is where they start developing abstract thinking, thinking about things in a very complicated and abstract way. There's actually a fascinating book, The Spiritual Child, written by Lisa Miller, who's a researcher at Columbia. And she's done a lot of research, modern-day research, about how kids develop spirituality, not necessarily from a Jewish perspective, just in general, how they develop spirituality. And as much as we sort of have a difficult time with teenagers, and we think of teenagers in a lot of negative ways, but she has shown that adolescence and the teenagers is really when the brain and their development is the most germane to spiritual development. That's really when spiritual and religious development can happen in the most significant way. And so if we're dealing with an older child, a teenager, they almost certainly will ask the theological questions. How could God let this happen? How could good people be killed? And therefore, in those situations, again, if you feel equipped yourself to answer the questions, you can get into discussions with them. And if not, again, you could say that's a really important question. Let's go ask the rabbi, the rebbe, the teacher, the mora, whatever it is. In terms of their ability to feel the pain of others, so this age is actually where that really develops in a more significant way. So school-age children can understand sympathy, which is that another person is in pain, is hurting, is sad, is upset, even though I'm not. But it's still a separate person. They don't really feel the pain of others. Empathy, as opposed to sympathy, empathy is when you can actually feel the pain of others. You really think about it deeply. You put yourself into their shoes, and you really can feel the pain of another. And that's really a lifelong skill for everybody, for all of us to work on. But at this age, at adolescence, is where the empathy really develops. And therefore, again, in helping these teenagers channel that empathy into meaningful acts. So again, if it means collecting tzedakah for the families, if it means doing some chesed. I think there was a beautiful video of people who were pledging to do certain things for the victim of Pittsburgh. And again, obviously it depends if it's a tragedy in the community. If it's in the community, lo aleinu, we hope that there's not. But then they could really be active in terms of hospital visits, in terms of actually doing real chesed for the people affected by the tragedy. And therefore, again, because they're capable of empathy, they can feel the pain of others, you really want to channel their reaction to these events into doing something meaningful for others, where they could feel that they are actually helping ease the pain of the other people. And so, to close, we really want to strike this balance between not underreacting, but not overreacting to these tragedies and these traumas. And again, we have to keep in mind the age and the development of the children. We don't want to say the wrong thing to each child. And, if we do say the wrong thing to the child, depending on their level, it could actually have negative consequences. So we really want to be very intentional, very specific about what we say to the children, what we don't say. And again, if we're able to really keep that in mind, be open with them, give them the space to talk with us, not force it down their throats. We don't have to say, you need to talk to me about this, but really give them the space to talk about it, to be open with us. And if they don't want to talk, they don't want to talk, but they know that we're there to listen to them, then hopefully they can help us achieve that balance, and we can help them achieve that balance between not underreacting and not just dismissing these as happenstance, as the Rambam tells us, but not overreacting and not giving them this paralyzing iron yoke of anxiety, but really striking that balance between feeling it but not getting too overwhelmed by it. Thank you. Questions? Yeah. So we have one. Okay. Yeah. So we can ask a few questions. We just ask that if we keep the questions general, it would be really irresponsible to answer a question about a specific child or family member without knowing that person and knowing the situation. So if it's a general question, then definitely I think it would help everybody's understanding. Yeah. No. It's like ask the doctor's class.
The question I have is social media and the adult use of it, because often you find an adult who are thinking they're doing the right thing easily overreact. How then can you talk to an adult about that they really need to either think about what they're doing before they either post or comment when it concerns an emergency, or prepare them for when a situation arises to take a moment and not kind of just get involved with the flow with everybody else when those things are going on?
Not a response. I think it was about adults, right?
The question is how. Repeat the question. I was listening, but you're talking about how you can set limits.
How can you counsel adults beforehand or during the whole process with social media? The adults can sometimes want to react. And they are often they're overreacting online. And it affects communities by how they type or what they put in there. How best can you deal with that, both either as preparation to prevent them from getting involved in this overreaction, or if they are, how do you get them to understand that maybe it is an overreaction, that it's outside the bounds of really what's going on in reality?
I can only offer two thoughts because I don't have an answer that would in any way change human nature. But human nature is that when we're caught off guard, when we hear about other people's suffering, or we hear about a scandal, or we hear about something that's shocking or something that's exciting, when we have access to social media, the time between hearing the information and responding is very, very quick. And what that means is that the brain doesn't mediate, it doesn't really process the information. So people are being hyper-reactive the moment they're not using words, but they're using their fingers to type. Literally, the beauty of being able to articulate words is that you're activating parts of the brain which filter, which screen, which ideally use judgment before making decisions. When we're not using verbal language, but we're letting our thumbs or our fingers do the typing for us, so we're really not putting a lot of thought into what we say. And as a result, a lot of what we do is impulsive. It's exaggerated. It's amplified emotion. It's using buzzwords or vulgar words or weird words to express something. And unfortunately, once it's in print, once it's out there, it can't be retracted. So that's what goes on anytime we're resorting to a keyboard to express our thoughts and our feelings. I said I would say two things. The second thing I want to say, there is a study that came out just a couple of months ago that gives the best recommendation for training adolescents and adults to mediate before typing their response. And what the study says is about the only thing that's effective is to send the message to yourself. Send the message to yourself and then read it a few minutes later, edit it, and in the editing process, the claim is about 70 to 80% of the time, when you see what you sent and you read it yourself, your editing will mean you'll opt not to send it to anybody else. So that's about the best I can do. There may be some other questions. Yes?
Yes, so there are adults who have an inordinately strong reaction to hearing about these terrible events like this, really, so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all feel terrible, and there's sort of a process to go through where it's intense at the beginning and it becomes less intense, but there are those who will carry with them for a long period of time. They can't sleep very well. They're watching the news maybe obsessively. There's a heightened fear that it's going to happen imminently in the bike. What kind of advice do you have for adults like those to deal effectively with their feelings?
Well, like I said, if it's persisting for more than about a month, then I would definitely seek consultation from a mental health expert and see if it's really a significant clinical either disorder or issue to be dealt with in therapy or in treatment.
I thought we were talking about a PTSD type of situation.
Right, right. So this sounds like it's not clinical PTSD,
yeah.
It's sort of subclinical symptoms. But again, if they're persisting for more than a month, then it's clearly significant, meaning the duration is going on for more than a month, it's clearly affecting the person in a significant way. It's not, it doesn't seem to be petering out, following normal course of abnormal reaction. So again, I'm not saying that they have clinical PTSD, but it could be something to work on in short-term therapy.
Well, I would, if I, may I just embellish Dr. Klein's learned answer, and that is that, as I suggested, it's entirely normal, and in fact it's healthy, to have a reaction to horrible news. The incubation period for, as you said in the name of Dr. Frankel, the normal reaction, which is the abnormal feeling you have after an abnormal event. So the incubation is usually about 72 hours, which means that we expect people who've heard horrible news to be affected by it for about 3 days. And very, very briefly, because it's a long, long lecture, but being affected by it means that either you can't stop thinking about it, or you have repeated images of what you saw on the television or on the computer, or what you saw on the scene, that something in you... Is that meant for me? That's never happened before. That was a trauma. But I know what to do with it, so it was just a crisis. So again, you can have physiological responses. You feel nauseous, or you can't sleep, or you can't wake up, or you're short of breath, or you have rapid heartbeat, or you have an emotional souring inside of you, which means you're sad, or you're worried a lot. But there can be a range of at least five different dimensions of change, and those are entirely normal for about 3 days. They should begin to shift, and they begin to taper, or the particular mode in which a person's reacting after 3 days should shift. So that means that the first couple of days he couldn't eat, but after a couple of days he can eat again, but he can't get the sounds of the crash out of his head or the sounds of the gunshots out of his head. After 3 days, you expect a little bit of either tapering of the symptoms in general or a shifting of the way they present. If they persist for more than 3 days, while it's still not diagnosed as PTSD, it's called acute stress. It's called acute stress, which means that the best thing you can do for yourself is to find someone you can talk to in confidence about it. That might be a therapist, it might be a rabbi, it might be a rabbitson, it might be a spouse, it might be a very close friend. But someone who can, someone who will allow you to talk through what you're going through without judging you, without criticizing you, without telling you what you should do or what you should stop doing, and just listen supportively, and give the parts of your brain which have shut down an opportunity to wake up by finding verbal language to express it. So that's what we would suggest after 3 days. A lot of what our interventionists do on Dr. Klein's forthcoming team is we will send out our volunteers, most of whom are not clinicians. Many of them are lay people or clergy people, but they're trained specifically to get that conversation going, to get people to have that monologue with a skilled listener. So if the symptoms persist for a couple of days, that's what you want to consider doing. It's only if they're just stuck, if the person's on chronic tilt, that the brain's not rebounding back. That's when we would prefer them professional help. Now, whoever was who told me to be quiet, your turn. Yes.
Okay.
For
me, somebody who's suffering that would not have been a trauma.
Okay, so the answer to question two is easier than the question you asked first. The 3 days of numbing, so that's also a traumatic reaction. So you say it takes 3 days for you to actually allow the stuff to come to surface. It's not that you weren't reacting for 3 days. The way you reacted for 3 days is by numbing out. So that is a traumatic reaction, but by about 3 days, that should lift or shift into a different modality of experiencing it. So what you're describing is a very fine example of what I was describing. Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you know, the Germans have a great word, Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude means that somehow we develop or we have a perverse delight in looking at other people's suffering. And sometimes when there's horrible news, we deal with it by becoming absorbed in everybody else's tragedy, and we get a certain delight. It doesn't have to mean a delight that we're rejoicing that bad things are happening to other people. The Pasuk in Mishlei speaks against it. Benfola yivcha altasamach. We're not supposed to look for delight by rejoicing in other people's misery. However, sometimes what people do by immersing themselves in all the details and all the images and all the newspaper, and they want to hear over and over again everything that's posted on every blog, is it's a way of reminding themselves that it happened to someone else and not to me. So it's sort of, if I become the expert on somebody else's plight, then that reminds me it happened to them and not to me. It's sort of a way of trying to keep it distant by becoming absorbed in it. We actually find a source in Chazal like this. You may know the Gemara. Rashi brings it in one place that it says that when the waves of the Yamsuf, we talked about that earlier, so it says that some of the soldiers, the Egyptian soldiers, when they saw the tidal wave coming at them, they ran into it rather than running away from it. That happens sometimes, that when there's a tragedy, we sort of dive into it rather than keeping a distance from it. We're better off not saturating or drowning ourselves in all the news and all the updates and checking in on our smartphones if we have them, or our computers if we have this. We're better off not immersing ourselves in that. The only time I would tell someone that it's important to be on top of the bad news is if you're in a position of authority, such as a teacher, a parent, or a clergy person, because what we routinely will tell people is that when you hear rumors or you hear new information emerging and you don't know whether or not it's true, we will always tell them, don't share it with your friends, check in with a person who's on top of the situation. You may know, without going into great detail, but there was a very bold statement that was circulating on the internet indicting people in Pittsburgh who had the tragedy and trying to assign blame to them for an alleged event. What surfaced a week and a half later, if you followed the research on this, this was all fabrication. The things that were being alleged about people in that shul were not at all true. It was an agenda, a within-group agenda, and yet by time the retraction came out and the sanitizing of the people who died, by the way, Rav David Feinstein said it's appropriate to refer to everyone who died in Pittsburgh as Kedoshim, regardless of how religious or not religious they were. He said to our organization that when we refer to them as Kedoshim, people who died al-Kiddush Hashem, they died because they were Jews. The point is that there's so much loose misinformation out on the media, it's just not worth pursuing it unless you're in a position of authority where people are going to come to you and ask for facts. Okay. Sermon over. Other questions? I don't want to occupy other stender. Other questions for Dr. Klein?
Through that numbing process where she sort of didn't feel anything. So I didn't clarify. I did continue seeing her for other issues not related to the trauma. So I actually did see her for a period of 4 to 5 months, and throughout that whole period she did not, even after, you know, the initial period, she did not show any signs of having symptoms from trauma. But your point is true. I mean, even if initially they don't show anything, it could come out. It could be a delayed reaction, or it does come out after a certain amount of time.
How do you know if they're fine or?
Well, if it's your child, then you monitor them. So if you see their behavior, their mood, and anything change, even a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after the event, then definitely, you know, keep your antenna up. It could be from that event. Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't there be a learning experience here through this whole thing? Terrorism is growing in this country more than it's been ever, and certain people be waking up to certain things and taking steps to not be in denial about it and just go back to their routine as if nothing had happened. I'm hearing that we're supposed to process it out and just go back to Meisim B'chol Yom like nothing happened. I don't think that is right either.
Is that what you heard either of us say?
I thought that's what you were saying, but after 72 hours, we should return to a normal...
Well, if that's what I said, that's not what I said. But if that's what... Okay, I'm relieved. Okay, good. So we can talk about that. I'll tell you something. My team and I went out to Kansas City after the Klansmen shot up the Jewish community center. We flew in a couple days later, and we processed with the adults, the teachers, the rabbis, the parents, the children. I don't know how many of you knew about what happened there, but a Klansman came, and he gunned down people at the Jewish Community Center, and then he gunned down people at the Jewish Home for the Aging. As it happened that day, the Jewish Community Center was holding a dance for the local Christian church. All of the victims of the shooting were non-Jews. When the Klansman was sentenced about 2 years later, the judge asked him if he had anything to say, and he said, yes, my only regret was that I didn't get Jews. His charata, he regretted that he had only shot non-Jews. So it's a horrible tragedy. We spoke for the non-Jewish community and the Jewish community, and then this question came up, well, what are we supposed to do? Meaning it's one thing to handle this as a trauma. What is the lesson we're supposed to derive from this? Is there some purpose we can take away from this tragedy? So the community actually did activate itself. They talked about having more security. They talked about lobbying with local politicians, many of whom are Klansmen. The best friend of the shooter was the mayor of the next borough, who was in on this. It's a different part of the world. We hope it doesn't happen here. But they talked about political activism. They talked about security guards. And they talked about bringing out our department to train a team within the Jewish Community Center, but that was staffed by Jews and non-Jews alike, all of whom were victims or witnesses that day. So they are now, they now comprise two crisis teams for all of Jewish and non-Jewish Kansas City. That's Kansas City, Missouri. So Kansas City, Missouri now has two Project Chai crisis teams that will go in any time there's a tragedy, any time there's a crisis. We did other things, interventions at the school level to help the children come up with projects so that they could build up their feeling of security. So we don't just deal with the clinical end. We deal with activism also.
I'll just tell people to learn how to shoot.
You know, the closest, Moshe Perry.
That we do this later.
Yeah.
Moshe
Perry.
Question. See, this is putting your head in the
sand. So allow me to respond. The closest I will come to teaching people to shoot is when I am the chazan, I will do chazoras hashatz. How's that? Okay. Okay.
There you go. So the whole thing is just buried in the sand.
Well, I hope we're not going to bury anybody, sand or otherwise. But if you would like to talk about with me, I will say Gunzula Tova, and we can...
It doesn't help. It doesn't solve the problem.
Yes, I get the point. I'll tell you on a delight...
Last question.
Last question, please. Oh, any? Maybe
any
that was
questions?
The last.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So our particular department will go in when there's been a crisis, or will go in to prepare people for an expected crisis, such as when someone is moribund, someone is approaching the end of life.
However, our team will not go into a mental health crisis that's in progress. And for that, we will defer either to the PET team at the police department, or we will refer them to a community agency. But we have a continuum, and when there is a mental health crisis going on, sometimes Hatzalah will take it, and sometimes Hatzalah will consult with us about how they should go in. But we are not the appropriate address to go to if there's a mental health emergency. And there you need professional intervention.
Is there a Jewish team?
No. No. No, most communities outside of New York don't have them. I don't disagree, although this is not something that our department would take, but it's the type of concern that lobbying with us, with Hatzalah, with the police department, with LA Department, County Department of Mental Health, probably with the Aguda to do some political action. So these are the types of things that should be on the community's agenda. And without spending a lot of time on Moshe Perry's observation, that this is his concern is also the type of thing that needs to be on the community's agenda in terms of where do we turn? Is it a matter of arming ourselves? Is it a matter of hiring armed guards? I know my shul has an armed guard every Shabbos morning. You don't get into shul without him. But after the Pittsburgh shooting, which was 2 weeks ago, the Shabbos following, he was too scared to show up. So we didn't have a security guard. We had an insecurity guard.
Yeah,